Hey, good afternoon, everyone. I saw this article on Facebook, and I thought we'd sit down and talk about it, try to make it a little bit more practical and real. Let's get Nate to read in the beginning. Why don't we do that?
About that? How should a pastor think about his salary? Dear Pastor Brandon, I hope this finds you prospering in the Lord. I am writing you about prosperity, a lack of it in my case. The ministry trouble I'm experiencing now relates to money. No wonder Scripture says so much about this topic. My church plant is doing fine financially, but my family is struggling. We have 4 children and have incurred some medical bills of late, have a mortgage, and have incurred lots of other expenses related to providing the basics for a family. But my pastor's salary is just not cutting it. At the end of the month, the amount needed to provide for our needs always seems to outstretch my income. How do I work through this? I know God has called me to be a breadwinner for my family and also to pastor a church, yet one doesn't seem congruent with the other. What should I do? Should I ask for a raise, find a ministry position that pays more, get a second job? Talking about money makes me feel incredibly guilty, because I realize ministry is not about money. Still, my family has to eat. My education and experience are completely ministry related, so getting a second job would be tough. I'm not even sure it would really help, and it would only tire me out further and risk lowering my energy level and available time for preaching and shepherding my congregation. Also, how can I guard my heart so that I don't become obsessive, extremely stingy, or worse,
stingy.
So it's so hard for a pastor to talk about money. I'm afraid my congregation will merely view me as greedy. Will ministry ever meet my family's needs? Am I just thinking wrongly about all this? Faithfully, your son in the faith, Going Broke.
All right, let's transition.
All right, so dear Going Broke, for the first decade of pastoral ministry, I enjoyed the luxury of never having to worry about money. Working in several affluent megachurches afforded my family a premium salary, generous insurance and retirement benefits, and huge margins for savings. 7 years ago, however, we experienced a financial crash when our decision to plant a church in urban Indianapolis forced a massive pay cut and a savings account depletion. My security was threatened for the first time as an adult. The financial habits that I had considered virtuous for much of my life, hard work, aggressive saving, minimal spending, and calculated generosity, worked for me in the prosperity of my previous context. But in the face of this unexpected financial strain, I became obsessive, controlling, and manipulative with my family's finances. Something had to change, but I had no idea where to start. Recently, I was leading a conversation on ministry finances with some young pastors in my city. I asked, "Is your current compensation sustainable for your family's next season of life?" Unsurprisingly, all of them said no. If you could have a candid conversation with the people responsible for setting your compensation, how much would you need to make to support your family at a reasonable level? Their answers reflected what I've consistently observed over the last several years. If these pastors didn't receive a substantial increase in their salaries, they'd need to pick up a side hustle, look for another church, or leave ministry altogether. So, problems unique to pastors. The recognition of universal struggles, however, doesn't negate the existence of some unique financial constraints on ministry families. Every vocation has its own set of occupational hazards. Let me highlight 2 that operate unconsciously in the social architecture of a local congregation. Local church ministry can place a constraint on wealth-building opportunities as typically defined in America. In most modern work environments, employee compensation is directly tied to measurable performance indicators like sales, profit, technical competency, billable hours, networking, overtime, and industry experience. Success in these areas leads to financial incentives like promotions, bonuses, stock options, equity, and even lucrative consulting gigs that help build long-term wealth airbags. Ministry, on the other hand, operates with a different set of rules. Churches are nonprofit organizations whose budgets are limited by external factors. Generally, pastoral compensation is determined by a constellation of subjective measures unrelated to performance, tradition, cost of living, level of seminary education, preaching aptitude, or even perceived reputation. Ministry success is ill-defined, and the lack of financial incentives creates a low ceiling for long-term wealth-building opportunities like saving, investments, retirement, or college funds. You guys want to stop there or go on to number two?
Do number two, and then we'll talk about them both.
Number two, local church ministry can place a financial constraint on pastors' wives. Despite the fact that more than 60% of families with children younger than 18 in the United States are now dual income, some congregations still hold an unspoken expectation that a pastor's wife doesn't work outside the home and doesn't receive any compensation for work she does for the church. Although, in some contexts, pastors' wives may find it desirable or necessary to work exclusively at home, the archetypical traditional family structure is a social pressure few outside the church must manage. This assumption puts pressure on single income families. Consider how it makes women and children financially vulnerable to tragic pastoral failures such as addiction, depression, suicide, and adultery.
All right, that's enough to get started. We'll talk about the conspiracy of silence in just a moment.
Speaking of silence.
Yes, yeah. Awkward silence.
So, go ahead, Doc.
Well, I was just going to, you know, the original question from the pastor writing in, I guess I just struggle with the fact that, you know, he says he's doing a church plant, and yet he doesn't feel that if he got a part-time second job that it would tire him out further and risk lowering his energy level for preaching and shepherding. Well, I mean, how, if it's a church plant, how many people is he shepherding?
Well, there's no real person, right? So this author cleverly came up with his own little letter of introduction.
Perhaps, yeah.
Well, yes. This is, I've pulled it off for printing purposes, but this is actually part of a larger book or a larger work. I'll see if I can find it real quick.
Okay. Well, I didn't know if it was like a question-answer thing and somebody actually wrote in and asked him this, and this was the guy's actual struggle. But, you know, I guess I'm just thinking, you know, most guys that are going out to do a church plant, they might be bivocational, or they might have to understand that they have to work a second job or go deliver pizza at night or mow yards on the side or do something to help out, and they shouldn't be so busy or involved in the, you know, the church that they can't do that.
I'm not sure it would really help. It would only tire me out further and risk lowering my energy level. Well, isn't the bottom line assumption with this is that I should be able to have a good standard of living from preaching?
So the editor's note on this while you guys are thinking is, this article is an adapted excerpt from a new book, Faithful Endurance, The Joy of Shepherding People for a Lifetime, from Crossway, and it's edited by Colin Hansel and Jeff Robinson. And it's addressing what does it look like for a pastor to lay down his life for the sheep for the long haul in a local church. And then it's just addressing the fact that this is...
And then his other comment, it's hard for a pastor to talk about money, my congregation will view me as greedy. I don't know. I mean, I think if he met with his leadership, you know, the men of the church or whatever, and, you know, if he had his budget or said, you know, this is how much I'm spending, and it was within reason, he's not being extravagant, I don't know too many men that work hard and provide for their families that are going to look at him and say, well, you know, no, suck it up and just
pounce
out. Yeah, I mean, you know, most men realize, you know, I want to provide for my family just as well as you do. And if you're here as our pastor, then, you know, we don't want you to be starving and not providing for yours.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like he is the initial, whether it's manufactured or not, still he is asking what should I do, so it's not like he's put himself in a corner that I have to ask for more money. Would it be worthwhile to prioritize or place in order what should be the first option, second option, third option of what he's
Well, the article suggesting. Doesn't do that, so why don't we...
No, and that's one of the things, one of the comments I saw, or a couple of different comments, is that all it does is address a problem but offers no real solutions.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to do the podcast. John, why are you being so silent?
Well, there doesn't seem a lot to talk about yet.
All right, well, let's get to reading then, because...
Well, I mean, if we're going to...
But if the article never brings up anything to talk about, I guess we could just jump
in. Obviously, if you're the leader of a church, the first thing that you should do is go, check, make sure, okay, am I wasting money? No. All right, I'm going to go talk to my men, the men of the church. I'm going to talk to whoever is responsible.
All right, so Steve wrote down, number one... Go
ask for more money.
Go ask for more money. Go.
And if they tell you jump in a lake, then you ask why. And, if it's because they don't have confidence in you, then, maybe it's time to go. If they say, hey, we'd love to, but the church budget can't afford it, then at that point, you
have a decision to make.
Right. You work another job, or it's not like you can make people come to your church, but, put more focus on that, getting new people in and integrating them into the ministry. But at the flip side, if you want to feed your family, you might have to do something on the side to make that happen. And you sleep a little less. And
it sounds like this guy doesn't want to do that.
Right. But, you do what, I was always told you do what you have to do to make it work.
Yeah, this guy doesn't want to do that.
Let's read about the conspiracy of silence.
As if these problems are not discouraging enough, there's a deeper, more dystopian shadow at work. Nobody is allowed to talk about any of it. Denominations, missions agencies, and financial teams are not bringing the conversation to their pastors, nor are many of my pastor friends initiating the conversation with their leadership teams. How do we live and lead those trusting us if we are unwilling or unable to discuss the truth about money? When we attempt to ignore money or deny its power in our lives, we ironically end up empowering its dark side. Unable to articulate the stories and feelings that shape our relationship with money, we become complicit in the conspiracy of silence plaguing a number of churches and pastors' families. I first encountered this weird silence in a conversation with a ministry friend who served at another megachurch. While describing his church's hiring process, he said, "We don't share compensation information before hiring someone. We don't want money to be a factor in a person's decision to take this job. We want them to trust God to provide for their needs." As a person who didn't grow up in the church, I ran my own lawn business as a teenager and majored in business during college. I found this conversation bizarre and naive. I exposed some of the unspoken assumptions that pastors face with money in the church. Is it really a lack of faith to inquire about the details of compensation before accepting a ministry role? Why would trusting God preclude the exercise of one's God-given mental faculties to discern whether a particular opportunity is a good stewardship decision for one's family? How much should money factor into a decision to accept a ministry calling? Who determines what constitutes a reasonable standard of living for pastoral ministry? Why many pastors choose to suffer silently? The reality is that these struggles conspire to create regular feelings of anxiety, isolation, and powerlessness. Money tells a story.
Hold on, let's see if John's heard enough.
Yeah. He set down his article. He's ready to speak.
Yeah, I just wanted to see where the article was going, with the conversation, because, of course, my mind's going in several different directions. But I think the main question is very important to our society today, because you could insert art history, you could insert musician, you could insert, so here's the reality in our society. There are jobs that people get paid well for, and then there are jobs that people, let's just be honest, they like to do those things, but people aren't going to pay you a lot of money to do them unless you're like the select few at the top. Like, if you want to arrange film scores, yeah, there's a John Williams out there that gets paid, $50,000 every time he picks up his pencil to write another Star Wars soundtrack. But there's thousands of aspiring film score people who have $100,000 in debt from college that are never going to score a single film.
They make $5 off your download on the internet.
Well, they make $7 an hour at Barnes and Noble. I mean, at Starbucks.
And what job are you talking about, John?
Film score, writing music,
For you know, movie.
Background music.
I've never heard of that.
Really?
Scoring? That idea, that word, no.
Yeah, you know the music from Star Wars and all the... John Williams wrote all of the...
Indiana Jones trilogy and Star Wars.
Yeah, all of the Spielberg movies. Yeah. He wrote all those music.
And those guys don't get paid anything?
No, they do.
He's saying there's only one at the top that's going to make millions doing
it. But every person like me who likes to write music
Zimmer.
Thinks they're going to be the next John Williams. Oh. And so they'll go to college, you know, get this degree, you know, spend $80,000 to $100,000, and then end up, you know, bussing tables or whatever. So my point is that there are jobs out there that pay more. You know, like we've heard over and over and over, there's a shortage in the labor market for jobs like elevator technician and plumber and these jobs, because we've been sold this narrative that, you know, there are... And that's why I said art history majors. And now we've got things like, you know, black history and so, just so narrow.
Women's studies.
Women's studies. And these are, and what I'm afraid are, these are areas of interest. Yeah, they're interesting to the people who, like, I love music. It's interesting to me. But at some point in your life, as an adult, you realize, nobody's going to pay me for that. I'm going to have to find something. If I want my family to eat, I'm going to have to find something that somebody wants to pay me for. And the reality, I think, is that being a pastor is also one of those things. In our society, being a pastor is not on the high end of getting paid a lot of money. So then you're at a decision point. Do I feel like that, and that's his, you know, existential quandary right here, is do I feel like the hours that God has given me is worth making less money because it's more eternal reward, and so I'm going to say, well, my family's going to do with less, or I may take a second job and I'm going to have to work harder so that eternity, or am I going to say, no, it's the money, so I'm going to go get a secular job and I'll help in the ministry as a secondary thing. You know, there's like a tipping point.
Right. Yeah.
And I would say, personally, I don't think there's a cut and dried rule. Like, you can say one's right and what's wrong. You know, you beg the Holy Spirit. Get on your knees and say, am I for this job? And then, if it is yes, the reality is that, you know, I'm a musician. I pick music. I'm just going to make a lot less money. You know, I didn't pick business. I didn't pick, you know, a track that will lead me to being CEO. In fact, you know, I'm in a church as a music director. There, you know, you don't get like, okay, you're going on to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you
there are very few Chris Tomlins.
But you know, you've worked hard for 16 years. Go here to the next, be an administrator, and go here. And you know, oh, we like how you.
And he does. And he addressed that. It was, I mean, in the corporate world, when you've been there for 5 years, 10 years, you get bonuses. You get, you know, you get tenure if you're in the public school system. You have those kind of things that show up. But churches, that doesn't exist.
But I would say on the other side of it. On the other side of it, I think that churches, and I know he's dealing with the church plant, so it's not as fully developed, but when you go to work for a corporation, you, like, when you first get the job, I don't know if, I mean, you military, right? Other people worked other jobs where you go in, you get the job, and then you go in for the training, and then you fill out all the forms, and then you get the insurance thing, and they explain which, and they tell you about the 401k. There is somebody in this section called HR, and their job is to make sure you got all the forms and all this, but they also to make sure, do you want to contribute to your 401k? You know, do we match up to 1% or whatever it is, you know, and then they help you through that. But the reality is, when it comes to a church, you're on your own. And so for me, I didn't learn that stuff until much later in life, because I didn't have anybody going like on a corporate level, do this.
Yeah, Bible college doesn't cover that.
Right. And so I think churches could do a better job about that part, because that's like caring for your people stuff. That's not really just, you know, giving you more money stuff. I mean, that's like caring for you. You know, have someone, I'm sure these churches have somebody in their congregation that does that for themselves. Why not think, oh, maybe the pastor might need help with this?
Well, Nate was getting ready to jump in there, so let's just listen, please.
Well, it kind of went with Brian's somewhat sarcastic comment, but...
Oh, that wasn't sarcasm. That was true. I've got the Bible.
The third paragraph, I think, sets the whole condition where he says, my education and experience is completely ministry-related.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100% on that, Nate. I was going back to that same line. I wanted to drive right back there.
Because then you're setting the condition to where you can't win bread for your family and go to that job that's of high demand or, I mean, starting point at such a salary.
Yeah, there's yes and no. I mean, you know, I have, whatever, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, but and they're all in ministry, but, you know, there are still things that you can do.
But, well, and I would say that your options then are limited compared to somebody with a business degree.
Well, I'm not sure about that because I've been reading this book called Everyday Millionaire, and it's like 90% of these, I think they interviewed like 11,000 millionaires in the United States. 90% of them don't have a college degree.
Are you sure?
I was, my sister was just in town visiting my children. She doesn't come to see me anymore. And I was talking to her because she got a degree from the same Bible college I went to, but she got her degree in accounting and then went and started working for the hospital network in town, did nothing with her accounting degree, and now she makes more money than my dad, who's the server administrator of the Air Force Hospital's medical records. And so I was just asking, I was like, so if you would, if for your job you're in now, what degree would you need to get? And she said, there isn't one. I'm like, so just Joe Schmo could have walked off the street out of high school and gotten, you know, into you. She's like, yeah, pretty much. And I was just like, okay. But then the flip side, because I understand and I look at it, I'm like, okay, sure. With my Bible degree from Pensacola Christian College, I probably could not go and get a secular job saying, hey, this is, you know, to get, earn that credibility.
Right.
But the flip side then is what individual who has the business degree or the liberal arts degree, whatever it is, and some seminary training or none is going to get on at a church and with the church feeling competent that they know their Bible. Because, I mean, the experience I have is the experience I have. And so I sit back and I think, okay, so, you know, Pastor Sean, you came to Berean as a soldier, and then how many years, you know, 25, 20 years of pouring into this ministry of, okay, then we know Sean's prepared to be a pastor. Or doctor.
Which I have no idea how they thought that.
Or that, but then you got Steve Wilson who came, and he had the Bible college degree, and he took the road less favored, I'll say, out of, you know, that conversation, and now he's the executive pastor. And so it's like, okay, so there's got to be a balance somewhere of getting the degree that you could feed your family should the church close, and the reality of you're not going to get on staff unless you put yourself in some type kind of a position. Because if when we were looking to hire before, you know, we hired Nathan, if some guy had walked up and said, hey, I've got a history degree from NC State, I want to be your children's pastor, we'd be like, it's going to take a whole lot more of an interview process or some type of a trial and error system to figure out, is he worth his weight in salt when it comes to ministry? Because they have no ministry experience.
Right, so what are you
I'm just saying, there's got to be a tension, because we've had individuals in the past that, you know, were very academic and wanted to try to see if they could hold their own in ministry, and it was just like, nope, you couldn't do it. I worked with one in the middle school, and we've had him on the church side temporarily, and it's just like, just because the individual goes to Bible college doesn't mean they're going to make it, and just because they have the liberal arts degree doesn't mean that they're really going to be able to make it on the other side. And so there's got to be some level of balance of, I have junior level experience or entry level ministry experience, but yet at the same time, I mean, there's got to be some level of balance. Because if this guy is truly an individual writing in,
which he's not,
and he's got the secular degree and the MBA, and then he goes and gets an MDiv from any given seminary, how does the church know he's going to be an excellent leader for their church?
If he has an MBA and an MDiv?
Yeah.
He wouldn't be talking in this conversation. He would be writing in.
He wouldn't be writing in.
He'd have the qualifications to have a second job. I don't have anything that's going to get me a second job. getting a second job would be tough. Any second job I would have to get is going to be manual labor because I don't have any other skills. So I'm going to be cutting grass. I'm going to be slinging paint. I'm going to be doing something that's going to make me absolutely tired. So I'll, basically, I'm not going to be able to get the mattress off my back in the morning and go out and make any visits. I'm going to want to put the mattress on my back as early as I can when I get home, so I'm not going to put in any time studying and everything else. So I have this divisional piece going on with me, and I'm pulling through this Socratic's method. Let me use a Plato technique of somebody asked me this question, so now let me go into my diatribe of what I want to say because I'm dissatisfied that I'm not getting paid enough by my church. So, let's cut to the chase. That's where we're getting to. Churches pay your pastors well, kind of thing. My church plant is doing fine financially. Okay, what does that mean?
We're not in debt. Yeah. Well, if they're doing well financially, they should be paying him more.
Right. Yeah. But the thing of it is what is fine financially? But my family is struggling. We had some medical bills of late, okay? Medical bills of late, they can set up payment plans. They can do things that will work in that process. It seems to me that you're throwing out the medical bills because that's the medical bills of late. That becomes the condition in which that's just driving it. Maybe they were doing fine before, but now we can't do fine on my family. But the church is doing fine, so therefore the church should be taking care of me because we have this medical need. Well, why do you have this medical need? Is it because you're not out exercising? Is it because you're lazy? I don't know. You already have problems with energy levels. You're saying that because that's why you can't work a second job. So how many people are in your congregation for preaching and shepherding and everything else? How draining is it really? Are you running a church of 100? Are you running a church of 120? I mean, there's no quantifiables here. This is all diatribe set up. Why can't you go and do that? Is there something that's wrong with you that you can't get up and spend a little more time working? That you can't do a few less hours? I mean, the real secret to getting more done in the day is sleep less. I mean, it's just that fact. The people that have success get up early and they stay up late. And they work. The moment they get up, they start working. I mean, you get up at 4:30, okay, and awesome. You can't go make a visit at 4:30, but my goodness, you might not have to go to work till 8 o'clock. So you're up at 4:30. 5 by 5:30, I mean, how many hours a day do you need to develop a well-done sermon on a Sunday morning, especially considering the probability that you have a massive library to draw from? I mean, seriously.
Jack needs to settle down, man.
He does. I mean, he's staring down the microphone.
He's on a soapbox. I mean, this is ridiculous. That we sit here and we do this. And I get what he's saying. Money, he's going to get to that section in a minute. Money tells a story, and it does. Money says that you're valued. Money says that we're willing to take care of you. Money says that we're doing that. So what we really got to figure out is with this author is it his problem or is it his church's problem? Because I'm looking back and I'm remembering a church that I grew up in that had a split at 13 when I was 13 years old. So I'm old enough to kind of know what's going on. And the fact of the matter is the church had a declining attendance and a declining attendance and a declining attendance for whatever reason. I'm not sure what that reason was, but I do know the numbers kept shrinking. I mean, a 13-year-old can figure that out. There's less people here this Sunday than there was last. And over time, there's less people here. Which meant that the salary became an issue. So he goes to the deacons, and he's asking the deacons for the salary. He's doing what Steve said priority number one is. Okay, but he's not going to take option that you said, go figure something out and go do something about it. No, he's going to take the approach of here, I'm going to complain and gripe, so here's how I'm going to get more money, since the church doesn't want to pay me because the church is doing fine financially. Meant, yes, they're paying all their bills and there's this little surplus, but they need a strategic fund in case something breaks. It can't necessarily go into the pastor's pocket. So he starts in with, I know what I'm going to do. And I kid you not, 12 Sundays in a row was about tithing.
12?
12. Till the entire deacon board said, we're done. And they didn't vote him out because there was enough old people there that loved him and wouldn't vote him out. They left and started their own church. The entire deacon board left and started another church. And I went with them in that church split. As a 13-year-old, I made the conscious decision to make that split. And they hired a bivocational pastor because that's what they could afford.
I wonder why the article doesn't even address that.
The idea of being a bivocational pastor.
What do you think, John? Why do you think the article
drops his energy levels too low?
Well, because author worked at mega churches.
I didn't read the article before we started this, so I'm not going to know until we're done. Reading.
Okay,
all right. So,
but that's what
I read the whole thing on Facebook, and that's why I was.
I didn't know we were doing this article
today. Yeah, that's fine.
For Jonathan's sake, money tells a story. Financial anxiety is an ancient problem. In Matthew 6:19, Jesus identifies our compulsively anxious relationship to money as one of the barriers that hinder our ability to experience the good life. Matthew 6:25. Jesus invites us to see that money is not some commodity we make to secure goods and services. It's a primal power that can also make us insecure. Money functions like a narrator or storyteller. It excavates the hidden motivations, values, myths, and longings that unconsciously drive our patterns of feeling, thinking, and behaving. In other words, how we relate to money reveals more than our financial principles. It uncovers our true ambitions. The story of money, both taught and embodied in the life of Jesus, is an invitation to the dual nature of human flourishing. Jesus invites us to stand in the tension of both freedom and sacrifice. By freedom, I mean the financial flexibility that offers good choices aligned with our human vocation, and by sacrifice, the willingness to risk financial loss for the good of others. The tension exists in the interdependence of freedom and sacrifice, in plenty or in want. In the story of the kingdom, money answers everything by providing the freedom for us to enjoy what truly matters in our life as human beings. But that freedom must always be circumscribed by solidarity and sharing the most vulnerable in our sphere of influence. Instead of obsessing over his basic needs, Jesus enlisted a group of trusted friends who funded his ministry and freed him to love, heal, teach, and serve his disciples. Rather than accumulating privilege and status for himself, Jesus redirected his power for the benefit of the most needy through intentional acts of vulnerability and sacrifice. This pattern of freedom and sacrifice yielded a life of surrender, contentment that unleashed flourishing for Jesus and those whom he loved.
All right, can we stop? Mm-hmm. What is this? What did that mean? I mean, it was 1, 2, 3.
I think it meant, and I don't think it's a great example, because, you know, the God of the universe owns everything and he's secure in himself, so that doesn't, I'm not really sure how that argument helps me, but I think what he's basically saying is his friends paid his way so he could be about the ministry.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, how does that relate to his article? In other words, how is that helpful?
It's not dealing with the tension or the problem the problem.
Right. Instead of obsessing over his basic needs, Jesus enlisted a group of trusted friends who funded his ministry, freed him to love, heal, teach, serve his disciples. So is he honestly suggesting to the dear Pastor Broke,
his problem is he doesn't make enough friends who...
That he's obsessing over his basic needs? Or that he needs to enlist a group of trusted friends who fund his life?
Well, that's what it sounds like.
I mean, I just read that. I put on Facebook that the article doesn't provide any pragmatic help.
Yeah. No, and I could... being Christ-like for your Christian life is absolutely an excellent exhortation, I don't know that pragmatically speaking for living, you know, a successful stewardship life... that we compare ourselves to the Son of God.
Look, there's only two options. I mean, every marriage counseling class I do, you either earn more or spend less. Mm-hmm. Those are the only two options. I mean, in the most simplest terms, when you're in a financial situation, you either, one, earn more money, or two, you spend less. And if you really want to make a difference, you do a combination of both.
Yeah.
You earn more money and spend less.
It's like you eat well or exercise. If you really want to lose weight,
you do both. Right. I don't understand how this guy is not trying to help his listener, reader, person who wrote the letter with some more. Because we're getting ready to go into three distorted views, and it's got to be really clever because it's the gospel of security, the gospel of suffering, the gospel of stoicism.
got to be Baptist, then.
Right, it's got to be Baptist.
Yeah.
Every pastor in church has a set of organizing assumptions that provide an implicit framework for how they relate to money. The problem is that few people acknowledge the narratives that drive those assumptions. I believe the two basic narratives of money, freedom and sacrifice, provide this subtext for the financial anxiety experience in ministry. All right, again, what does that mean?
Well, I think he might be trying to get at the fact that the businessman, this exists sometimes, the businessman who is working hard to increase his bottom line constantly, gain more customers, always thinking about earning more, is like, oh, you're in the ministry, we don't need to pay you more. So there's like a double, so like, you decided to be in the ministry, you just sacrifice. That's what Jesus' life is all about, is sacrifice. You want to be like Jesus? I'm business, it's cutthroat, we go for the, you know, go more, but church can't be like that. Church has to be all about grace and sacrifice.
You have an eternal reward.
It's almost like communism, you know, church is like communism. Everybody gets a piece of the pie, and, you know, and maybe that's what he's trying to attack.
The next sentence says, if we experience too much freedom without sacrifice, we can quickly become preoccupied with ourselves and isolated from the concerns of our neighbors. Ministry in this framework becomes another vehicle for pursuing our own comfort, security, and lifestyle privileges. So is he saying that's like guys who make a lot of money, that's them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Guys who are in it for gain.
Okay. All right. If we experience too much sacrifice without freedom, we often become overwhelmed by the needs of others while ignoring the welfare of our own families. Ministry in this framework becomes martyrdom, with families feeling trapped and obligated to long hours with little pay.
So number one, you've got the pastor who make this. In our examples, he's at a mega church getting, you know, plenty of financial aid and help. And then number two, it's now you're at the church plant and you're barely making ends meet.
All right, stoicism. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, the gospel of stoicism. So if we lack both freedom and sacrifice, we fall into the worst story, stoicism. Ministry in this framework feels like a cold war, where desire is stifled and everyone is passively resigned to waiting for others to make the first move. Nobody feels empowered or motivated to speak up for the financial health and well-being of the church or its leaders. This is probably the most common narrative I witness in church planting. It's rarely intentional, but so many churches, especially younger and more idealistic communities, suppress honest money conversations. So leaning into the tension, what does it look like for pastors to flourish financially? Dear pastor, rather than seeking to balance the tension of freedom and sacrifice, I want to invite you to consider leaning into the area that is most underdeveloped in your life during this season. If you pushed too aggressively into sacrifice in a way that has left your family feeling depleted, my story, then maybe you need to lean into freedom and make some decisions that could amplify your joy. If you fall into patterns of comfort and security, then maybe the call is for you to lean into sacrifice and embrace downward mobility for the good of others. Either way, I'd strongly encourage you to invite a community of trusted friends and advisors into this process with you to help you see past blind spots that may be keeping you from experiencing the comprehensive flourishing into which God has invited you.
Okay, John, did you get that?
Yeah, I think he's addressing two tendencies. Mm-hmm. The one tendency is the pastor who's all about making money. And the other tendency is the pastor who's all about sacrifice and not making enough money. And at the end of the day, what he's saying is, you need to be balanced. Which is kind of like...
I wonder why I didn't say that.
Kind of like what you...
Because he's writing a book.
Feel like Brian and Nate have a big leg up because they're sitting around a table like this discussing this now. But, you know, it took me a long time to figure this out. And, you know, the biggest examples are the examples that are modeled for you. And, you know, my dad was in the ministry and lived on the sacrifice side. So I tend all the way over to that, you know, a church member calls you at 3 a.m, you're going to... So the question becomes, okay, for that kind of person, you know, who are you called to minister to first, your family or the church? And that's something that every pastor has to wrestle with and finding that balance. You know, of course, I think you're called... for your family first. I think that's the way God created the world first. And the calling to be a pastor is important, It's immense. However,
it's secondary to father and dad.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think way too many pastors still have this struggle. And so I see that. And then probably not as often on the other side. There are some pastors that are in it for great gain. They probably have great names and notoriety, and they're probably a very small percentage. Probably most fall into the other one, other category. I suppose someone who has a church plant could potentially have a bivocation where they're like really working hard and they're earning but kind of neglecting their church plant. Probably not, though, because a lot of those guys really have a heart towards the church plant to start with.
Yeah, I'd say you'd probably find that more in the small church.
Yeah.
The idea of that, what you just described. I don't know about the church plant, but you can say they're one and the other. I think you're right, Pastor. There's no real help here. There's no, hey, okay, great, wonderful, philosophical, but what do I do? What are some steps? What are some questions I can ask? What's really going to help me along? So I came up with five.
Okay, let's hear them.
Steve, you know, he gave us the first one. Go ask the church. If it's really doing fine financially, go and see, can you give me more help? Can you, you know, what can you do for me? Is it a pay raise? Is it a love, generous,
benevolence
okay. to help me with my bills that have come
if it late. Were the medical bills that came right, up just right. in these 2 months and that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Can you work with the people you owe? Okay, if the church can't do anything, can you call the people that you owe and work out smaller, lower payments?
Budgeting,
control. Okay, how much time, maybe you need to go and ask your deacon board, how much time do you expect me to spend in visitation? How much do you, okay, you can't pay me more.
Right.
How many hours then do you realistically expect
Based
me to
pay.
Have so that I can know how many more hours I might be able to go and do some side work mm-hmm. so that I'm not sacrificing my family, that I'm not, you know, at that point. Realistically, look at yourself, most people can do more than they think they can. Most of us stop far short of really what's truly the point of our break. Okay, and I'm not suggesting that everybody has pushed to the breaking point, but what I am saying is you need to ask yourself and look deep inside and say, okay, how much more could I do? Could I really work another couple of hours? Could I, without sacrificing my health, my family, after they've gone to bed, put in another hour's work? Could I put in another half hour's work? What is your realistically that you as a person can handle? Some people require more sleep. Some people don't. Now, Pastor, you and I seem to be people that don't require as much sleep. I don't know if it's because we've built that habit through the military or if it's just innate in us. I don't know. I know that my wife can't function with the reduced amount of sleep that I use. I know she can't.
Jackie, before you, just I'm asking for clarity. So you mentioned a couple hours after your family is in bed or whatever. So if you go get a side hustle, what are your options then for getting one where you could actually be an effective part-time employee somewhere and complete those ministry tasks?
Well, that's why you have to find out what is your ministry expectation. You know, if they expect me to make X number of visits or anything else, could I get all that done in the morning and have an afternoon job, mm-hmm. come home to my family, spend some time with my family goes to bed, and now I have enough energy that I know I can stay mentally focused enough for an hour and a half to do studies, to do pastoral studies. Because I did my pastoral expected out in the community work already. You see what I'm saying? That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. So you're not only you're budgeting your money, you're budgeting your time and your energy.
Yeah, I mean, I was just sitting here trying to think, you know, like, okay, so you go and get a part-time job at a corporation or a company in town, and they're going to want you to work whatever shifts,
yeah, but,
and then it's like...
Yeah, but we're talking...
But that's a bivocational pastor, Brian.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah, I understand that. I'm just trying to think in my brain, like, okay, if that were me, how would I, you know... So then I'm automatically off. I have to request off on Sundays and Wednesdays to, mm-hmm. you know, from my side job.
And then, in addition to that, I either have to not schedule youth activities or any other ministry, you know, things that would go on in an evening so that I can devote that time to this other job.
Yes.
And so I'm just trying to, as we're talking through this, I'm like, okay, what would I do if I were in that position?
Okay, and what will drive a lot of those decisions goes back to what does the church expect?
Yep.
So clearly we're looking at some things. Can the church help me? Are they really as financially solvent as I think they are? So can they help me? Can I work out a budgeted payment plan? What is the church's realistic expectations of me? How much time can I really give up? My age of my children might be a factor in that. Health of my wife. There's a lot of things that are in that we don't know from this story, but that's a thing that has to be determined. And if all those things say, I can't continue at this location, then I have to go to that fifth one. Is God calling me somewhere else?
And I think that there are some, we can add to the list too, that there are some myths that we need to bust, that church members need to bust. And one of them is that, you know, God just miraculously puts food and stuff on the pastor's table, and that
too many George Mueller stories.
You know, just yeah, you know, you're praying and it just arrives. No, you know, when the pastor goes down to the grocery store, they ask for money, just like when you go down to the grocery store. When the pastor's tires wears out, you know, it costs the same amount of money that it does for you to replace. And so, you know, this scenario is just too nebulous because we don't know what kind of church he is. Because there are, I mean, I have lived in churches where the deacons expect the pastor to live at way less than a level. And then I've gone to some wonderful churches where the deacons just want to give to the pastor and say, you know, he should be honored above others. So there is that factor. And the hard part about our church in particular is that we get people from all kinds of church backgrounds. We don't get just Baptists anymore that were fundamentalists.
Right.
And so we get, you know, Church of Christ people. We get, you know, churches with no denomination. We even get Catholics and stuff just because of the military nature of our town and I guess the shifting nature of church in general. We have all these people from different backgrounds coming in our church. And I think one of the things that I do agree with them is we really don't talk about this very much to the church congregation. Occasionally we do at members meetings when we talk about, hey, you know, when we go down and get an air conditioner, they want money too. But as, you know, I think part of the issue is we don't really have an idea what the church, our church in particular, thinks about money and how the pastor should be paid.
Or at least that leadership portion of it.
Right. And then the whole aspect of, you know, you want to think about your time and money, you know, the two things that we have, or, you know, actually we just have time and we turn it into money, though, that kind of idea, you know, then am I using that money and that time on myself, or am I using it for eternal purposes?
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely somewhere in the discussion and has to color, because I've been, you know, I'm in a different time in my life now, so I'm thinking about retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to do when I can't work? And, you know, who's going to support me? And all of those issues. But what I've also noticed is, man, the amount of free time I have now, because I don't have to go to ball games for my kids, you know, show up for this and this and this, it's almost like it's reverse. It should be the backwards, because now I could get that second job and make more money, but you don't need it as much because you don't have as little kids, you know, who need shoes that wear out and clothes and all of that.
Or they outgrow them.
Right. And so my point is that I'm now considering, okay, if I have $500,000 at retirement, so what? Who cares? I mean, what? I want it to be for a purpose. Do I, you know, I want it to be so that when I die, I can give it to my church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, when you get a certain age, you realize you're going to die, number one. That's, mm-hmm. You know, it becomes, you know, closer and closer. Yeah. It used to be 50 years away. Now it's 30, 20. You know, mm-hmm. You start, the target starts. So you think about the finality of it, and then the eternality of it, and then the who cares, so what thing, you know? What did I accomplish, you know? Am I doing things that are going to matter for eternity?
Well, I don't think we're going to...
I was going to ask you one question.
Yeah.
Close up. You, when you first started doing lawn care and stuff like that, and it was just you and Austin,
mm-hmm.
About what was the average time you spent on a yard?
on a single yard,
mm-hmm.
the two of us,
mm-hmm.
an hour.
About an hour, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And going rate, $50.
$60.
$60, okay. So $60 times two is 120. So you just got a person, they might spend an hour. So let's say a guy can go out and do a yard for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
He can spend 2 hours a day. He's going to make $120 times 5 days a week.
$500, $25,000 a year.
Yeah. So could you not find 2 hours a day in all of your duties to supplement your income with about $500 a week to help catch up on the bills? That's the kind of question that needs to be asked.
I mean, I think John's right. We ought to spend a little bit more time talking about this in a more pragmatic way than just this article. So we need to look for something more to talk about it. But we need to be coming up with practical ways to help people through their financial struggles, because the struggles are real.
Well, we're not denying that.
No, we're not denying that. But the solution to the struggles is what needs to be discussed. And I didn't think that the article provided enough solutions. Well, if you have a better article for it, we'd love for someone to give us a recommendation, post it on one of our Facebook pages, or send us an email. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.